Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of The Debate on Press TV. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. The United States has always maintained full-fledged military and financial support for Israel. On many occasions, Washington has even gone as far as violating international law and human rights to perpetuate its blind advocacy for Tel Aviv. On the other hand, there are reports of AIPAC and its donors holding fundraisers unofficially so that the money does not show up on disclosures as coming directly from AIPAC. The Israeli lobby is said to have influence on U.S. Politicians and politics. What's behind it, decades-old U.S. support for Tel Aviv? How far has the Israeli lobby infiltrated the U.S. deep state? An international event called the New Horizon Conference explores such questions and tries to shed light on the darker side of the Israeli-American sinister relationship. Now, joining me in this debate will be founder of American Institute for Foreign Policy, Michael Lane, out of Washington, D.C. A managing editor of Veterans Today, Jim W. Dean, joining us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Welcome, both gentlemen. Now, let's go to Michael first. How deep has pro-Israeli lobbies such as AIPAC penetrated the U.S. politics, and how much control do they exert among American politicians?
Well, trying to influence the federal government or any government in the United States is one of our protected constitutional rights. And you can do it either individually or you can do it through an organization such as AIPAC or any of the other thousands upon thousands of organized organizations like that. We have in our Constitution the constitutional guarantee of the right to petition your government, which is essentially what lobbying is. And we have the constitutional right to freedom of assembly and freedom of association, which is what an organized effort is to influence the government. There's no doubt that AIPAC is a very influential organization. They've been around for a while. They're good at what they do. They're skilled. They're influential, and they have the ear of a lot of people, policymakers in government, both on Capitol Hill and in the administration. However, there are other groups that work virtually opposite of what AIPAC does, so they are not universal and they are not monolithic. In the Jewish community, there's another organization by the name of J Street. J Street is similarly very organized and very influential. They are certainly not on the same page as AIPAC. They lobby for different kinds of things. They are certainly not a Zionist organization, and they are certainly not a fan of Benjamin Netanyahu or any of the other Israeli governments. So although AIPAC is influential and effective, they're by no means the last word in the United States government.
Mm-hmm. Let me put the same question to Jim. Jim, how far do you think the influence of AIPAC and groups like that go among the U.S. politicians?
Well, we have to take a look at the organization behind this. The American intelligence community knows that if you want to influence the government, you don't necessarily do it right in the open. You try to use fronts, one with a very established reputation, one that already has some power that people fear, and you try to come in behind them. And if I were a foreign intelligence officer, I would look at AIPAC as the prime example of someone that I would want to have front for my intelligence operations. Israel, I might add, is known in the community as a wholesale intelligence operation. That means, along with targeting certain things that they're wanting to get, like new weapons development, they're also tasked with stealing anything and everything they can get their hands on that could be in any way useful to the Zionist state. And what they need for themselves that they don't want anybody to know that they have, they take, and then they fund part of their operations by selling something that off to other countries. And they have sold military technical material to China and also to the Soviet Union. When Pollard was busted, unknown in his story, that he was being pointed at where to go and what documents and where they were located and what the file names were. And he just actually went and collected them, copied them, and brought them home. And one of the things that he turned over to Israel is all of the CIA undercover agents in Eastern Europe. In Syria, I mean, Israel actually gave those to the Soviet Union as part of their deal to get the large number of Russian immigrants to Syria. And the CIA basically lost 1,000 of their whole East European undercover network, completely wiped out, which was such a scandal. It's never been publicly admitted or published by anyone in the United States except veterans today.
Now let me go to Michael. All governments in the United States have always lent full support for Israel, regardless of who has been at the helm of the White House. President Trump has cut aid to UN agency UNRWA that reaches out to Palestinian refugees. He declared Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which infuriated the Palestinians. He closed the PLO office in the U.S., and you name it. So the question is, what makes American statesmen ignore others' rights, all in favor of Israel?
Well, there's a historical relationship, a very good relationship between the United States and Israel, going back to Israel's creation by UN resolution. Israel is a military and an economic ally of the United States, and also they are the only real democracy in that area, and being a democracy and a friend of the United States makes them even that much more of an important and a close ally. While the East, you know, they can shift, they can ebb, and they can flow depending on the circumstances and who the players are. Israel at times was very isolated, and in current times has a number of friends in the area. Basically, our policy is developed, and our friendships and our alliances are developed in concert with allies that have in mind the same vision for the region that the United States has. And that's probably the primary reason why the United States and Israel get along so well. But we also get along with other countries in the region, such as Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, other ones, et cetera, that have the same view that we are. Let me add Bahrain to that as well. When you look at the countries that we don't get along with that well, perhaps we would mention Iran and Syria and a few others. Those are countries that we have a different view, a different vision of what safety and security and peace is like in that region. And that's why the relationships tend to become more adversarial instead of alliance types relationships.
Now, Jim, Nikki Haley was a hardcore supporter of the regime in Tel Aviv. Recently, the newly appointed U.S. ambassador to the U.N. has also assured Israel that it will have no better friend than her. Kelly Kraft has also stressed Washington's unflinching support for Tel Aviv will continue as it has in the past. How does the U.S. benefit from this unwavering backing for Israel, which is at the cost of victimizing others and trampling upon their rights?
It really doesn't. It basically makes the U.S. Co-sponsor of Israeli terrorism against its own citizens, including its neighbors. I would disagree with Michael's characterization of Israel being the solid democracy in the region, which I would consider a joke. I mean, how can you call a country a democracy when they have millions of people living in the West Bank that can't vote? And the Arab citizens that live inside the country have been relegated ethnically to a lower class. So, if he wants to hold them up as a beacon, beacon of democracy, he's welcome to do so. But a huge amount of the world disagrees with them, and so don't a whole bunch of UN resolutions. So what we have here is Israel is able to get away with this, not only by their political influence in the U.S., but Britain, European countries, and their intelligence agencies are also involved in this, a full front assault to be able to punish anybody in politics that does not toe the Israeli line, is going to have an opponent running against them in the next election, well-funded. And if there's anything in their background that's hidden that could embarrass them, Israeli espionage agents can do things like if someone running for office had an unfortunate incident in high school with a young girl, say maybe 15 years old, and that record and that case was sealed, because both of them are minors. Israeli intelligence people can get that file in 2 seconds and send it to them. They can compromise people that have anything that they're trying to keep hidden. And if they get elected, they can hold that over them. And we don't find our French or British or German allies doing anything like that. But Israel, on standard, runs those types of intimidation operations without any inference from the FBI, because the FBI does not decide who they want to investigate. The Justice Department does, and that's a political appointment. And the Israel has always been able to avoid investigations. In fact, we ask people all the time in intelligence and law enforcement, when is the last time U.S. law enforcement has broken up a major Israeli espionage operation in the U.S.? And basically nobody can remember.
Yeah, and there was this recent one also recently. Again, Michael, it's a sin in the U.S. to say anything against Israel, no matter who you are. No room for honest disclosure either. You know, an example is Republican Representative Ilhan Omar, who has been harshly criticized as anti-Semitic. What's the root of all this intolerance and bias?
Well, first let me make a small correction. I think you misstated that Representative Omar is a Democrat, not a Republican. But the alliance between United States and Israel has been longstanding, as it has been between the United States and Saudi Arabia and other countries in the region. In fact, the United States was an ally of the of Iran before the Islamic revolution back in the late 1970s. So we do have a history of getting along with both sides. But certainly Representative Omar is coming in and trying to change the nature of the discussion and change the beliefs that the United States has generally held as a country over the past several decades. As such, she's swimming against the tide, fighting an uphill battle, if you'll allow me one more metaphor. And anytime you come in and you're different and you're trying to change things and you're trying to change people's minds against things that they have believed for decades, it's going to create conflict, and it's going to open yourself as a target for criticism. And it's going to make people, you know, frankly, just dislike you based on what you are standing for. That's an unfortunate thing, but I think that happens in almost any society. Representative Omar has suffered from being a freshman representative, and she's made some real rookie mistakes in the way she has phrased certain things. I believe she was the one who said that on September 11th, 2001, some people did something and that caused her to react. The reaction in the United States against that particular comment belittling the 9/11 attacks was simply visceral. Mm-hmm. I believe that if she finds a way to mainstream her language and her behavior over the coming years, she'll perhaps be more influential.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jim, let's have your comments. And then also regarding the Israeli influence in the U.S., that you see the U.S. Department of Education recently announcing that if you criticize Israeli policy, you will lose your federal funding. This happened to the Consortium of Middle East Studies receiving this threat, which forced it to change the content of programming, which focused on cultural studies like the one that is called Love and Desire in Modern Iran, instead of advancing the U.S. security. Let's have your comments.
Well, what's going on here is Israel sees the trend of more and more people becoming informed on the history of Israeli influence, pressure on elections, influence peddling here, compromising our political system, also rumors that they've also been able to compromise the judiciary in a lot of situations. And they're really afraid of this growing trend. So what we have going on now, they're trying to actually criminalize any political speech or disagreement. You can disagree about anybody, any country, on any issue, except for Israel. And what they did is they twisted the hate crime laws and used their patsies in Congress to say that any criticism of Israel can only be motivated by hate, and therefore anybody that criticizes Israel will be exposed to all the hate crime legislation. And this is an open, flagrant attack on the U.S. First Amendment, And really, the opposition against this in Congress has been pitiful, and it's been pitiful from the country as a whole, in the civic groups to not have spoken out more against this. So this is the bullet in the head. As I said, we really want to eliminate all opposition by able to have it have criminal penalties that we, the Israeli lobby, don't have to bring. We'll make the American taxpayer pay for it, and we will have the American police and the American legal system basically try and imprison American citizens on their First Amendment rights.
Now, Michael, I'm going to cite two examples for you regarding the extent of Israeli influence in the U.S. media. We had Helen Amelia Thomas, an American reporter and author who had a long-time membership in the White House press corps. She criticized Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands in 2010. She was forced to resign afterward. Also in 2018, CNN fired its contributor Mark Lamon Hill after remarks criticizing Israel and calling for a, quote, free Palestine. Are the mainstream media as free as they claim when it comes to Israel?
Well, things have certainly changed. Whereas the media was almost universally of the viewpoint that the government and the American people were as much as 10 years ago or more, that Israel was our ally and that there were any adversary of Israel's was potentially an adversary of the United States. And clearly the conflict directly involved the Palestinians and the Israelis, so that would make a little bit more of a sharper microscope looking on any comments to do with that. Things have changed in the last 10 years. I would say that our general media has become at best a very neutral observer. You have some very pro-Israel things that are written and said, and you have some very anti-Israel things that are written and said. Certainly, Israel receives a great deal of criticism for their policies in the West Bank, and that's almost universal throughout the American press. And Donald Trump receives a great deal of criticism for the allegations that he is too close to Prime Minister Netanyahu and not broad scoped enough in the way he approaches the whole thing. So there's an evolution going on here, and I think that the examples you cited are older examples that would not take place today.
Okay, let me ask Jim about the same thing. Jim, you have 30 seconds.
Well, I agree with Michael a little bit here. Is yes, you do see the press making such statements, but I would call that they're covering themselves, that they're being fair. The administration and even some of the Israeli critics really don't mind what you say publicly as long as when it comes to policy, that is not reflected in policy, it's not reflected in funding, and it's not reflected in real pressure of twisting Israel's arm. For instance, if you don't stop shooting Palestinian children in Gaza, we're going to cut off your foreign aid. You'll never hear a peep about the real issues. So really, this soft criticism is just a smokescreen.
Okay, we come to the end of this program. I want to thank our guests. We had founder of American Institute for Foreign Policy, Michael Lane from Washington, D.C., and managing editor of Veterans Today, Jim W. Dean, out of Grand Rapids, Michigan. Thank you for watching this program. We'll see you next time.